chapter 6, extravagant generosity. I'm sitting on the beach this evening, watching the swells roll in towards me. Each wave builds as it approaches, ascending, taking shape. Deep greens below, sweeping upward into translucent aquamarine, a sculpture in motion, curling forth like shavings from a jade carving. The sheer elegance is enough to take my breath away. The wave I'm fixed upon crashes to the sand like a work of art toppling from its pedestal. But before I can feel the loss, another is rushing to take its place, sweeping forward, upward, utterly mesmerizing beauty. Then comes another, and then another, and another, in an unending processional. All things were made through him, comes to mind, and without him, nothing was made that has been made. What are the waves telling us about Jesus? An artist is revealed in the work that they create, and in the abundance of the work they create. Think of the ocean. Picture it in your mind. Tonight, the breakers are thundering on the reef 100 yards out, and beyond that, open ocean. What does this tell us about Jesus? What words come to mind? Majestic, powerful, wild, dangerous, tempestuous, like the clearing of the temple, but also gently playful as it laps at your feet, pulling the sand away from beneath you as Jesus ever so gently pulls the rug out from underneath us. I look down, scattered at my feet by 1,000 shells, delicate, intricate, the work of a jeweler, an artist with very small tools and exceptional eyesight. If all this is the work of an artist's hand, what does it tell us about the artist? Everywhere around me, an obsession with beauty and attention to detail. But most of all, I am thunderstruck by the extravagant generosity strewn around, constantly rolling in. It's as if someone took the family silver and ran down the beach, tossing handfuls here and there like a madman. How do you describe this extravagance? What kind of person acts like this? On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My time has not yet come." Pause. What is his tone of voice at this moment? It makes all the difference. Is he being aloof? Is there a sigh of impatience? Is he irritated? Be careful what you read into this story. His response to Mary seems rude, but that can't be. We know he adored her. My goodness, while hanging in agony from the cross, he arranges for her care. Okay, the beauty of their relationship is revealed here as well. She knows all she has to do is ask. There couldn't have been anything condescending in his reply, for she simply turns to the servants and says, like a good Jewish mother, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. And then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." This, the first of his miraculous signs, Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. 6 stone jars, holding up to 30 gallons each. That would be about 180 gallons. John makes a point of saying that the jars were filled to the brim. 180 gallons equals 682 liters. That would be 908 bottles of wine. I know. It's almost too much to believe. It seems too extravagant. But the scripture makes a point to telling us exactly how many urns there were, how much they held, and even pushes the point that they were filled to the brim. Apparently, the quantity Jesus produced is important to the story. And I'm certainly not going to begrudge Jesus the right to be generous. But watch this. If you want proof of the current religious spirit, its ugly nature, watch how folks freak out over this. Okay? Websites will crop up. Theologians will step forward to argue the amount, right? Look, I didn't do the miracle. I just did the math. Okay? John says he thus revealed his glory. What is it exactly that Jesus thus revealed? I mean, certainly his power over creation, but there's something else here, something beautiful. Jesus did not provide cheap wine, as the maitre d' expected, given the lateness of the hour, nor did he make a statement by substituting grape juice. He didn't give them just a little wine, say a dozen bottles, to wrap up the evening with one last toast. Jesus does it lavishly, to the tune of 908 bottles. Here's the same stunning generosity we see pouring forth in creation. Oh, the beauty of Jesus. The text declares he hadn't planned on revealing himself at this time. Might this help us with our own prayer life? Ask and you shall receive. Seek and you shall find. Knock. The door will be opened. Jesus would not have urged us to pray if he were unapproachable. Now, bailing the groom out of an embarrassing situation wasn't Jesus' intention. My time has not yet come. But he does it anyways, without a hint of grudgingly. 180 gallons of top-grade hooch. Late into the reception? The crowd has already emptied the cupboards. What is it, close to midnight at this point? This party is going to carry on for hours. What joy. What gladness. How celebratory. Just like Jesus.
It's been a while since we've talked about abundance. You know, we seem to go in cycles. And you know how we have a tendency to go too far this direction and then wait, let's reel it back, and so we'll go too far in this direction. But we need to explore abundance in regard to his generosity, and not just the material things. If you look at in creation, when he said, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, I don't think God likes things to be empty. He likes things full. He gave the same command to the birds of the air, the fish of the sea. Be fruitful, multiply, fill up. And he reemphasized after the flood that nothing's changed. Be fruitful, multiply. So I think in those terms, he wants to fill up what's empty. He not necessarily crowd it, but more than enough. You know, Keith Moore, he did a message one time where he's talking about if you held out a cup and God were pouring, you know, it would start to get, you know, close to the top. Whoa, hang on, it's spilling over. And God's like, yeah, isn't it great? And it just keeps spilling over, you know, and spills into the hallway and out the door. He gives you more than enough. Let's start with that. How would you describe extravagant generosity?
How would you describe, I'm sorry, say that again?
Extravagant generosity.
He wants us to know that he's always there. make any difference what we draw on. He's always sufficient.
They can't hear back here.
She said that she thinks it doesn't matter what the situation, he's always sufficient. He is definitely all sufficient.
Well, he knows what we need and what we actually desire long before we do. And he's already working on it long before we ask.
Mm-hmm.
So he's more than ready, willing, and able, you know, to do whatever it is for us. Things that we don't even realize.
Take it one step further. Beyond all that we could ever think or ask. Hang on, Mark. Virginia, have your hand up.
That's fine.
I think sometimes we get so busy expecting God to exceedingly abundance us in the areas we think we need, that when we don't have, let's say, money or things or friendships or whatever, we tend to miss the big picture of his abundance in other ways. And I know that personally. I have to stop focusing. It's simply what he gave me with Debbie. You know, you're looking at the fill in the blank. Don't look at that. Look at me. You know, I'm your abundance. And, you know, I miss the abundance of maybe joy that needs to spill out on somebody that day. Or I miss the abundance of healing that I need to pass on to somebody that day or for my own self. Because I'm focused in, I'm not getting it this way, you know. Or this need isn't being met, you know. And he's extravagant. And he's extravagant in his grace to fill us up with himself at that point. That's more important than the things.
Mark?
I think this extravagance also teaches us a lesson, because even in, like, with the wine and even with the two times that he did the miracle of blessing the bread and the fish, it was clearly not intended to be all consumed in one time. You know, it was obviously intended to show that there's more than just today, and that God's got enough for tomorrow, and that maybe your vision for who should be included in the scope of your fellowship, the scope of your life, is smaller. Maybe the problem was enough guests were not invited to Cana, the wedding of Cana. Maybe God would have, if God had been the one handing out the invitation, the city would have been invited.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he provided for, regardless of who showed up.
Wow.
Mm,
that's right.
Do you see, though, how easily we get, you know, like you're talking about, sometimes, you know, we talk, like we did, we had a while where we were talking about abundance. And, you know, so much so that we felt like if there was an area of our life that wasn't full of abundance, you know, something
was drastically
wrong. Clearly, he said, the thief has come to steal, to kill, and destroy. I have come that you might have life and have it more abundantly. He desires for us to have abundant life. We're not always clear on what that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mark, he was talking about Sunday, you know, to the point of, like, he wants to fill you up so full that you're just about to explode on everybody. And what area in your life, you know, where he is demonstrating that the most is when people bump into you, that's what they're going to experience. If you really come to experience God's abundant mercy, then when someone does you wrong and they, you know, they not only rub you the wrong way, they practically knock you over, in the process, you spilled mercy on them.
Mm.
That's right.
You just exploded on them.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
You know, or maybe joy. You know, when God fills our heart to overflowing with joy, you know, it can't help but just bubble out. You know, someone pushes this and, oh! it just comes out. I think Abraham, when he was blessed, It says, which one? Actually, this was Moses. When God was about to pass by, he proclaimed, "Jehovah, Jehovah God, merciful and gracious, long-suffering, and abundant in goodness and truth." He's more gooder than he needs to be. He is abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, and who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of fathers on the sons and on the sons' sons to the third and the fourth generation. But for those who keep mercy for thousands, you know, I mean, when someone's heart is towards God and yielded, in other words, they allow God to grab a hold of their heart, man, what God can do through that person. I mean, he doesn't just do it. He really does it. I was pretty sure I wrote this down. Oh, here. In Genesis 17, God says to Abraham, "I will make my covenant between me and you and multiply you exceedingly." And then if you read about Isaac, you know, he multiplied exceedingly. You remember Abraham and Lot, they had so much. And this was God's blessing on it. You remember we were talking about the difference between the Abrahamic blessing and the covenant of Moses. You know, one was under law and performance, and the other was God's demonstrating, this is my covenant between me and you, and my intention is for you and your seed. Who is Abraham's seed? If we are Christ's, we are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. Okay, so Abraham's blessing is the one we want to look at. If you look at him, you know, they had so much possessions that they couldn't even be in one area together. They had too much. So they had to spread out. And what is the opposite of that is, he said, fill the earth, take dominion over it. But in Babel, they wanted to go opposite of that. And they said, no, let us stay here. Let us build one great tower, you know, so that, you know, we'll not be scattered throughout the earth. In other words, we want to take all that we have and we want to make a name for ourselves. Instead of taking all that we have and spreading out and making use of it, sharing with the world as we go. If you read, I'm pretty sure, was it John Locke? This is going back to my American history studies. But he did a treatise on two forms of government. And he talked about the way things were intended to be before there were governments established. And the fact that, you know, when if there's no boundaries, if there's no property lines, basically everything is common ground. So how would you say that someone stole from a tree if it belonged to everybody? Well, the test was, did they take more than what they could use without it going to waste? That was the test. And if you took so much that you couldn't possibly use it all yourself, and the extra that you had left over was spoiling on the ground, then you stole from your neighbor. So he intends to be generous, to show us his character, because that ultimately is going to be revealed in us, and to show us, I want to be extravagant, but realize that what I'm giving you is not just for you. When I forgive you, it's because I want you to forgive others. When I love you, it's because I want you to love others. Mm-hmm. He's just pouring it out, because it's bigger than the container it goes in. It's meant that way. Go ahead. No. I've got more thoughts, but go ahead.
Well, I'm sorry. Well, I was just thinking about the picture of the waves coming in, how powerful they are. And all of that's available. But they come in one at a time, as we can get them and as we can utilize them. and to the degree that we can utilize them. But he lets us see the picture so we know we can have more if we think we can use them or need them. I just see majesty there.
There's always provisions at the edge of the field. Mm. When the harvest comes in, and you notice he didn't just, you know, he didn't have the workers go out and bring it all in and form a line for people to come up.
Right, that's right. Right.
He said, if they're hungry, let them go to the outskirts, you know, and you know, they can pick what they need and eat it. Leave some, you know, for those who are hungry. But they had to be willing to come and, you know, support for it.
But I think he tries to develop a hunger there.
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, true, because if you're there working on the outskirts, at some point I think you might have the mindset like the second son. He's eating the pig slop, and all of a sudden it dawns on him. My father's servants eat better than this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you're on the edge of the field, you can't help but look and see what was in the field. You know, so it points to something bigger than what you currently have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he intended. The other thing that I was thinking, not just material, but his grace, his mercy. We don't deserve his mercy. It is such an extravagant gift because we don't deserve it. In Romans, he talks to the fact that man is inexcusable because, you know, God is, he's revealed himself. And chapter 2, verse 1 says, therefore you are inexcusable, O man, whoever you are who judge. For in whatever you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you who judge practice the same thing. But we know that the judgment of God is according to truth against those who practice such things. And do you think this, O man, you who judge and practice the same things and doing the same, that you will escape the judgment of God? Or do you despise the riches of his goodness, forbearance, and long-suffering, not knowing that the goodness of God is what leads you to repentance? The riches of his goodness. He's not just good. He is so good. His forbearance means he puts up with a lot. Over and over and over again. And you realize love is made possible when you're willing to be vulnerable. When you realize that if I peel this part of me away, it's not only possible, I'm going to get hurt in some way. To truly love someone, you have to totally open yourself up. And then, I mean, that takes a brave heart. So he's willing to be repeatedly rejected and scorned and laughed at and mocked and shoved to the side and continues to open his heart. That's extravagance. That's a love that not only can't we comprehend, again, as something we don't deserve, but that's, he just loves us that much.
And the world considers that a fool.
Yeah. She said the world would consider that foolish. You had something?
Yeah, I was just going to comment on the fact that one thing that's come to me a lot in the last several months concerning that very thing is that what frees you to love is embracing the fact that you are loved.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus was free to be able to pour his love out because he had fully accepted the love of the Father God to him. So you sense, and Terry and I were just talking about this the other day. She actually brought it up and we were just talking about how in the environment where you, you know, in the moments of time, I know we all don't live there, but the moments of clarity, when you actually open your heart up and you receive the love of God, it's like, well, what it enables you to do is you are so freed to love other people and love them well, because there's a lack of consideration for yourself because you don't sense need now. And you're not afraid of the impending hurt because there's a compelling on the inside of you to spend yourself on that person. You're more hungry to spend yourself than you are to protect yourself. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's not a sense of a need to protect because you feel protected. It's just it's completely counterintuitive to the way the world or even I, when I'm not having an on moment, think, you know. But it is reality. It makes me wonder. I would have to do a study. I don't know. But I'd be interested in knowing how many of the terms of abundance that are used in Scripture are when it refers to the abundance given to the individual has to do with eternal things like mercy, like righteousness, and how many of the natural things that are given in abundance are intended for meeting your immediate needs and then meeting the needs of those around you. I don't know the answer to that, but I would be interested. I'm suspicious that the places in Scripture where God talks about filling someone to the point of overflowing and being gorged is probably relational, not natural.
Oh, and God has called different people to different things. I mean, you were talking about the three sons and how their families have a role in the earth. One is to live spaciously in tents, and you know, subsequently, they finance the work of the brother who lives in those tents. So, depending on what family you're in, would determine, you know, how God uses you. And regardless of the state that you find yourself in, and this is where I think, you know, prosperity went a little too far. And I think we said it pretty straightforward enough that God doesn't necessarily intend for every one of us to be a millionaire. God does intend to meet all of our needs, every one of our needs. 2 Corinthians says, he shall make all grace abound towards you so that you will always have all sufficiency and all things with an abundance left over for every good work. That's his desire. So does that mean you're a millionaire? No, it just means you always have enough
to share.
Well, you have enough to meet the necessary needs, and you have an abundance. You have sufficiency for your need. You have an abundance for every good work.
That's right. I think the wave.
I think
the wave shows.
Yeah, because it just keeps coming, wave after wave. Absolutely. You're righteous. You are righteous, O Jehovah, or O God. And your judgments are right. In your testimonies, you have commanded righteousness and faithfulness exceedingly. He has commanded righteousness and faithfulness exceedingly. It's coming from him. He can't not be faithful. If there is something that resulted in a lack in our life, obviously we've gotten off of a path somehow. And that doesn't mean that our provision is reward-based. But sometimes we go through times of lack because it's necessary. Remember, he caused them to hunger in the wilderness. He was testing them. You were going to say something, Michelle?
You just said what I was going to say.
Okay. Anyway, the test in the wilderness was so that they might know that man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. In other words, my daily provision for you is nothing compared physically to my every word for you. I mean, there was a lesson that needed to be learned. So, in times of lack, that doesn't speak to his inability. It doesn't speak to his not being faithful. It speaks to what needs to happen at the moment to get our heart right. Because there's nothing more important than our heart being right with God.
Right.
One of the things that Jesus said, when people persecute you, He said, rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for your reward in heaven is great. He doesn't say, you know, when you get to heaven, thank God at that point, you know, it'll all be over and you'll be safe. He says, don't sweat this, because at the end of this and beyond is something you can't even imagine. It has not entered into the eye or ear of man the things that God has prepared for those who love him. We can't even conceive of, we see little snippets of his goodness and his love now, but I mean, it hasn't even entered into the heart of man the things that he wants to do for us in the ages to come. We think it's great now. We just have no idea. No? Okay. Imagine walking through a rainforest, diving over a coral reef. Simply look through a microscope at a drop of pond water. Creation is pulsing with life. It is the life of Jesus, given generously for the life of all things. He is called the author of life. This is the life he offers us. This is the extravagance with which he offers it. Jesus doesn't only give his life for mankind, but he also gives his life to mankind. It is showered upon us like daily manna. One last thought of extravagance, I would think, is in the variety that he has throughout the world. I mean, just looking at the shells on the beach, I mean, that's one example. That's a great example. You know, it struck me a little funny. You know, he said, you know, obviously this is the work of an artist with really small tools and exceptional eyesight. But, I mean, the intricate details down to the microscopic level and beyond. I mean, you think it's beautiful on the outside, you look at it under a microscope, and you just keep going further and further and further, and it just becomes more mind-blowing how magnificent it is. But, I mean, he didn't just create apples, bananas, tangerines, you know, I mean, grapes and grapefruit and nectarines and pomegranates. I mean, it's just crazy. Just thinking about fruit. And could any one of us name, even come close to naming all the fruits that there are, or all the different vegetables there are?
Flowers.
I mean,
the variety.
To those who are somewhat carnivorous in nature, the different meats that are available, you know? I mean, I'm not a fish person, and God knew that, so he created beef.
And pig.
Pig is good.
Chicken.
Turkey. And there are meats around the world that I wouldn't dare touch. But, you know, to some people around the world, that is, you know, I can say literally the cat's meow. People love cat in other countries. Anyway. The point is, you know, he knows the heart of every single person. And not only has he made more than enough, but, I mean, he's given you options that he didn't have to. I mean, it's like opening a library. Well, okay, it's just like, you know, your child lets a friend come over to play, you know, and they could say, you know, pull out just a few toys and this is what we can play with. Or they can just open up everything and say, hey, whatever's here, you know, let's have fun. Opening it up. All right. Let's go ahead and do the next one.
Chapter 7, Disruptive Honesty. In order to grasp the wildness of this next vignette, I want you to imagine that you have received an invitation to dine at the home of an influential diplomat. The governor, or your ambassador, will do. A number of dignitaries will be present, bishops of the church, Supreme Court justices, a prime minister. How would your insides feel as you rang the bell? How self-conscious would you be of your appearance, your manners? Alas, 30 seconds after you walk through the door, there is an awkward moment of tension, a delicate matter about forgetting to return the bow of the Dalai Lama. Your host is speechless. You can see from the look on everyone's face that you have committed something a step or two beyond an embarrassing faux pas. What would you say? How would you respond? When Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee invited him to eat with him. So he went in and reclined at the table. But the Pharisee, noticing that Jesus did not first wash before the meal, was surprised. Then the Lord said to him, "Now then, you Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness." Jesus has just entered this man's home, having accepted an invitation to dinner. Every guest who has ever passed through those doors has washed their hands before being seated, slavishly observing a custom unbroken for centuries. It is a test of orthodoxy and solidarity. Jesus knows this, knows that they are watching his every move. He walks right past the line at the wash basin, makes himself comfortable at the table. The Pharisee apparently is speechless. Jesus reads the look on his face and offers an explanation. "Oh, the washing bit," he says, and takes a piece of flatbread, breaks off a bite, and chews it. It completely clouds the issue. Outwardly, you look sensational, but inwardly, your heart is full of extortion and evil. The things Jesus says. Apparently, he's not concerned about being invited back. May I remind you that whenever you are watching Jesus, you are watching love? You can always hold that up as you encounter startling passages like this one. "I am at this moment watching love in action." Remember, Jesus is not strolling through the Israeli countryside offering poetry readings. He is on a mission to rescue a people who are so utterly deceived, most of them don't even want to be rescued. His honesty and severity are measured out precisely according to the amount of delusion and self-deception encasing the listener. When a soul is encrusted with pride, bigotry, self-righteousness, and intellectual elitism, as was his dinner host, then that shell does need to be struck hard at times in order to cause a crack that might allow some light in. Jesus strikes with the precision of Michelangelo. At another dinner engagement, this one at the home of two now famous sisters, Jesus is pulled into a sibling squabble. Now, as they were traveling along, he entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. She had a sister called Mary, who was seated at the Lord's feet, listening to his word. But Martha was distracted with all her preparations, and she came up to him and said, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the serving alone? Then tell her to help me." Okay, Jesus is a sharp enough man to know not to stick his head in a hornet's nest. These family quarrels have a long, tangled history, like Middle Eastern politics. Come to think of it, these quarrels are the long, tangled history of Middle Eastern politics. Martha demands Jesus take sides. He does, but not as she expected. He takes her side by speaking to what is going on inside. "Martha, Martha," the Lord answered, "you are worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her." Jesus is the guest, by the way, in her home. She made the dinner. If it were me, I think I would probably have tried to diffuse the tension by just offering to help Martha myself, skirt the issue, but it would leave Martha in her self-righteous snit. I absolutely love the loving courage of this man to say what everyone else knows but won't say. Jesus' tone seems very different here than with the earlier Pharisee. This is a softer blow. That's because he is dealing with a softer heart. You get the sense that Martha, though snarky at the moment, would be immediately softened by the truthfulness of Jesus' words. This is their first reported encounter. But the sisters and their brother, Lazarus, go on to become close friends of Jesus. Martha's home is his first choice of refuge whenever he is traveling near Jerusalem. Apparently, his words were just the right touch at just the right moment. Now, in order to appreciate how beautiful this is, think of how rarely it occurs, and how even more rarely it is done well. Most people go through their entire life without anyone ever speaking honest, loving, direct words to the most damaging issues in their life. Pause for a moment and count the times this has been done for you. Better. Pause and count the times you have offered this to someone you love. I'm not stunned by Jesus' words to either of his hosts. I'm stunned by the courage and love this takes.
Wisdom to speak truth in love. And it does have to be just the right moment in time. Their words spoken in due season, seasoned with grace. Due season is a very important thing not to overlook because it's the right time. When he says with the precision of Michelangelo, you know, it's seeing there's something underneath this rock. And you can't just chisel anywhere. You really do have to have a precise location for the chisel, the right amount of strength, you know, or you could, you're not going to bring out what's inside, you're going to damage what's inside.
It's like a gem, when they make a diamond that facets or something, they hit it wrong, it shatters.
Absolutely. It really does take wisdom beyond courage and love to speak this kind of truth. But when he said that anytime we see Jesus doing anything, we can be assured it's in a backdrop that he's doing it out of love. Even when he was angry at those who were, you know, selling and making exchange inside the temple, it was love for his father's house. It was a demonstration of love and respect for what he knew was right. So, does anybody want to testify to a time that someone was honest enough with them?
Totally honest.
And it made a difference? It's a hard one.
Mark has spoken to me. I remember one time, and you know, it's a reoccurring thing with me. It's like, I don't know, it's like a broken record. You just, it's, you know, you've got a scratch in it, and it's not going to heal, you know. But I do good, and then I fall back. But we were here one time, and he just turned around and spoke very sharply to me. And, you know, I recognized, you know, that was God speaking to me right now. And, you know, stop that. You know, stop doubting him. Why do I doubt it? Why do I doubt his love for me? You know, I can doubt... I can believe so many other lies, but why do I doubt the truth? You know, it's so stupid.
so an entrance was made.
Sorry.
God reveals things to you. I think if your heart is one to intercede for your brothers and sisters out of love, you're probably going to have a more sensitive heart to hear when and where to make that truthful, necessary statement. I don't think, in fact, I know, God would not reveal something. I mean, the heart of any one of his children is very precious. You know, and he's not just going to him, I think that would be, you know, pearls before swine. I'm not going to let you take this little nugget of something that person needs to heal a 30-year-old wound and just let you trample it underfoot. You know, basically just, you know, driving the nails into the coffin so that the person is never healed, but perpetually dead. There is a right moment. What if when he, you know, was in the house with the Pharisee, he did what he did because he knew that it would open a door. And, it was the right door, the right moment. I mean, he totally bypassed, you know, centuries of tradition to show that that's exactly what it is. And he showed it for what it was. But if he had, I don't think he could have just brought up, I don't think he could have, you know, washed, you know, and then, you know, I was thinking as I was washing my hands, why do we do this?
Right.
It was disruptive to the point that it peeled something back. It made people open up their eyes a little bit more. You know, whereas someone might have been falling asleep as he's, you know, talking about, yeah, I was just thinking. Everybody, I'm sure, was pretty wide-eyed at what he did. Give me some thoughts. Has anybody hurt you with honesty that years later you realized, wow, that was one of the best things anybody ever could have done for me?
I remember when, I can't remember a specific example of a person speaking to me directly, but they might as well have been. And in fact, for all I know, they were, but they were speaking to and I was in the group, and but it's entirely possible they knew that the Lord was giving that for me. I don't know. I say that to say that I want to make sure I qualify the situation, because the fact that I think what you're specifically talking about is a person coming to another person, but the impact was the same. There was a particular part of my heart that so needed to be restored prior to and during the time that I went to that encounter, that I had not seen the way I had been responding to God. I had constantly been in the position of wanting God to come save me, you know, and rescue me. But it was in a different light than I use that word now, entirely. What I was really wanting was him to come in and continually affirm something he's already spoken to. And the fact that he'd already said it wasn't enough for me. I needed him to say it again today and say it again tomorrow and continue to say it, because I don't have any security if you don't continue to say it to me, you know. And the thing that the guy said, this was at the encounter, he said, you know, that's, and you've heard me repeat it, and I told you it wasn't original with me, is that, you know, everybody who came to Jesus got healed, but not everybody that Jesus went to got healed. And he said, you know, some of you are sitting around in self-pity, and that was exactly where I was, and I hadn't seen it. Because it didn't have all the externals of what I would have labeled self-pity. I didn't feel the emotions of wallowing, but that's exactly what it was. And I had been wallowing in self-pity in this area of my life for a long time and had not seen it. And when he said that, it's like the scales came off my eyes and I saw it for what it was. And I realized, you know what, I go to him and I can walk away healed. But I don't have to follow him around 24 hours a day saying, confirm that you healed me yesterday. Confirm that you healed me yesterday. You know, I need to go to him and receive it. And in that area of my life, it broke it, and I haven't been back there. Mm-hmm. And it was profound deliverance, and I'm very grateful for it. But so it was an area where words that hit me hard, and in the right setting, it could have even probably hurt my feelings, but it wasn't the exact right thing to do. So I don't know if that's a good illustration of what you're talking about, but it's what comes to my mind.
I'll share something in just a minute, but I want to say two things. Number one, we especially in a group setting, and it doesn't even have to be a group setting, we've got to be careful as teachers, you know, because sometimes we want to address an issue that we see, and, you know, without, especially if you really haven't gotten a heart for the people that you're ministering to, you can call it discernment, but it's really just judgment in disguise, you know, and it's dangerous. You think that you're doing the right thing by declaring the truthfulness of the Word of God, but it wasn't the appropriate time. It was spoken through, you know, being judgmental, and that can really hurt. The other thing that I want to say is, and it will bring me into the story that I'm going to tell, is that sometimes if you lose courage in the middle of telling someone the truth, you can backpedal and completely undo everything that God was trying to do. I was in a relationship for 9 months out of high school, and it was during that relationship that I lost focus of what I knew that God wanted me to do. And at the end of those 9 months, she came to me and said, God told me that I need to break up with you. And if I didn't do it tonight, I never would. And the words that I spoke to her, I'm sure, had a very long-lasting, hurtful effect. Because I said, I don't know what you heard, but it wasn't from God. I mean, I was totally broken, totally devastated. But that particular relationship, though it wasn't a bad relationship, I totally lost my focus. And that was right before, it was in December. So here, we're coming up on New Year's. And now, you know, right after Christmas, you're thinking, you know, New Year's, what do I want to do? And I'm just completely broken. And I'm crying out to God. I'm like, I don't even know. What do you want me to do? And he told me, yes, you do. You know exactly what I want you to do. And I was broken enough to remember what I was supposed to do. It's a hard place to be, but it was the best place to be. And if she ever spoke to me again, I'd tell her she was right.
Yeah.
Anybody else want to be brave?
I think timing is everything.
Yes.
I mean, it's huge. Because the person that you're speaking to has to be in the right place to receive it.
Yeah.
And you've got to be in the right place to say what you need to say.
Yeah.
I mean, everything's got to line up. You know, God's got to have an order. He's going to do everything in decency and order. And we can't get ahead of him, or we're going to mess things up really bad. I mean, we're going to cause those hurt feelings. And
let me wrap this up in one statement. You can't say what needs to be said out of a heart that's offended.
Right.
That's true. Absolutely.
And because you're going to taint the message.
That's right.
So, yeah, and you're right. Both of you have to be in the right place.
Years ago, my brother-in-law was going through, his marriage was breaking up, and I had a book, I can't remember now the name of it, but it was a wonderful book, and I wanted to give it to him. It was about salvation and all of that. And I can remember just as clear as I'm talking to you, when I was, you know, I was really thinking about going down and taking, because he was my neighbor too, I was going to take him the book, and just as clear as you talking to me, I heard a voice say, "Not now." And it just kind of startled me, because that had never happened to me before. This was a long time ago. And but there came a time when it was right to give it to him. And when he responded to the book. And I know, knowing now what I didn't really understand then, was the fact that he wasn't ready, apparently, at the time I wanted to do it. And God knew that. And who knows what kind of harm I could have done. You know? So I thought that was kind of cool.
That is cool. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Mark.
Let me know if this is going the wrong direction with it, but I know that another thing that this speaks to is our ability to hear. And I think that you really hit a key point earlier. If we are walking in love with our brothers and sisters and carry them around in our hearts, we're going to be more sensitive to know what and when. Because if we are moved by the circumstance, the situation, or their response, we can completely misjudge a situation. I guarantee, based on the story that we read, of course, with Jesus, with those people having not washed his hands, that the dinner probably did not go well, the rest, and they hadn't even started eating yet. I'm sure it was quite uncomfortable in many respects. And there's no indication that those people responded favorably at all. But Jesus had to know that he heard from God regardless of their response. Just because a person responds poorly does not mean God did not tell you to do it. The big issue is whether it was, like Nancy said, the appointed time. And there is an appointed time. And that person may not be ready, and they should have been. But nonetheless, God said, now's the time.
Absolutely.
A little off subject, but as you know, when I saw the title, I chuckled because it made me think of Josh. Like, just how you have to be careful what you ask him, because if you don't want to hear the truth, don't ask sometimes.
What's the title again? I'm sorry.
Disruptive Honesty.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, like when the principal says, is this boring you? Don't ask him that. Because he says, yes, it is. And then you get a phone call. And anyway, it's just one example of
many. Commercial. Does this make me look fat? Do you really want to hear the answer?
That's right.
You know the answer.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But don't you think that's what God wants us really to be? Is like a child and just to be, I mean, kids, you know, they don't...
Forget all the cloak and dagger stuff. Just be straightforward.
Right.
You know? And I came by it naturally. I was raised to be diplomatic. To kind of skirt the issue, to go the long way around before I finally got to the point. I'm sorry, it's just the way it was growing up. So I've been doing better at getting straight to the point. But you realize you lose so much time. Sometimes you lose people's interest.
What was that point? What was that thought I was trying to get across, right?
You know, this is a little off topic, but especially if you need something from somebody and you feel like, I just really feel like I need to ask this person. And so, you know, you start with a song and dance to try and lead you to the real question, which is, can you do this for me? Yeah.
Do you know what? If we know that God's telling us to say something, and, you know, maybe we don't feel like or sense that that's right, you know, but we know it's Him. We never know, even if they don't respond or they respond the way you thought they would, you know, you never know what seeds, I mean, you plant seeds when they're going to come on,
right.
When they're going to be,
right.
Or, you know, they wouldn't let you know, but they think about it.
That is a perfect thing to think about whenever you're telling someone something that you know they need to hear, that you're pretty sure they're not going to respond favorably to. Because a seed breaks open underground, and what needs to come out, nobody can see when it first comes out. But it begins to grow, it begins to develop. And then eventually, something will shoot out. You know, so in the heart of man, where nobody can see what's going on, even though outwardly they might respond very unfavorably, you know, you might have struck a nerve that 10 minutes after the conversation is over and both of you have left, you know, it began to work. Mm-hmm. And you might not run into that person again for the rest of your life. I mean, you just don't know. You just, there have been relatively few examples of a time when I needed to confront, at least that I felt secure this was the right thing to do. But when I did it, you know, I it was just like, who was it that said it was like fire shut up in my bones? Was it,
Jeremiah.
Was it Jeremiah? Anyway, basically, I couldn't have not said it if I tried. You know, I knew, if I had left and not said what I knew I needed to say, it would have just eaten me up. So, you have that. I don't know that you necessarily always have a peace. I mean, it's more like, you know, trepidation. You've got so many thoughts going through your mind on what could happen. And, I think that's probably one of the reasons why Jesus said, when I take you to different places, when I bring you before kings, don't meditate beforehand what you're going to say. Because when it needs to be said, you'll have the words to say it. If you think about it beforehand, the wrong thing's going to come out your mouth. And
because
we carefully.
What needs to get said gets muddled.
Right.
Because you've got so much in its way. And that's hard to do, because how many times do you play something over and over in your mind about how you're going to say this or that?
Right. You know, it happened a lot when I was in middle school. I don't know why. Maybe that's just a developmental thing. But, you know, someone would say something to me in middle school, and as I'm going home, I would think of all the things I could have said. Why didn't I think of that?
Yeah. Yeah. Usually after the fact, me too.
Yeah.
Not beforehand, after the fact.
Maybe it's because it didn't need to be said.
I'm just getting to say, maybe that was good.
Others always
fine. Well, I think we really need to be sensitive to the Holy Spirit, you know, when to know, first to know that God is telling you to do this, you know, to speak into somebody, especially when you're speaking into somebody's life, you know, or delivering a message from Him. And I know it's happened to me a couple of times when God's told me to tell somebody something, and I'm like, you know, I mean, that person's closer to you than I am. What are you telling me for?
Right.
You know, and you question it. But it... There's just something, an urgency that happens on the inside of you, you know, and if you don't do it, you know, what kind of damage could have been done, mm-hmm. you know? And, but when you do it and you follow through, there is such a peace that comes mm-hmm. over you. And the person that you're talking to, they were receptive and they were ready to receive, you know, and it was like the exact thing that they needed at that particular moment. And whether we're planting a seed or watering a seed, it really, that's not our, we don't have to figure that out. You know, when we say something, we could be the one that plants the seed.
Right.
But you don't know. That seed could have been planted, and it's been sitting there dormant, and it just, you know, takes a word to reopen it. You know, and bring it to the surface and cause it to break ground.
So one plants, mm-hmm. one comes along and waters, but it's always God that brings about increase.
It's always God that brings the harvest.
You can do yourself a little heart test. If you immediately, I need to say something to that person. You know what I'm saying? You probably know at that moment. You might have the right words to say, you know, but a word spoken in due season, seasoned with grace. Mm-hmm. It has to be, anyway, if you've got that going on in your heart, if you've got bitterness and resentment and anger, shelf it. It's not the right time. You were going to say something?
Well, I was going to say, I think we speak into each other's lives daily. You know, it's not just this word coming from God, I know I'm supposed to say this. Mm-hmm. But we're speaking into people's lives daily. It's like, I think if somebody's talking to me, am I dismissive to them when they're talking to me? What am I speaking to them? If we're having a conversation and your phone rings and you're like, oh, I got to get my phone, when I'm having a conversation with you, it's like, what am I speaking to you?
Right.
You know?
Which is the beauty of the interrupt rule. You know, when someone comes up,
right.
Are you saying this person is now more important than, you know, hang on just a second. Go ahead.
I mean, I just think in our daily conversations of nothing, we think it's nothing that we are speaking to each other's lives.
Right. The absence of words, too.
Right. Like, if I'm always correcting you, what am I speaking to you?
Right.
I'm speaking, you can't do anything right if I'm always, you know.
Right. And a person that never hears, I love you, you know, that could be a big question in their mind. You know, just the fact that it's not being verbalized. You know, those are words that are necessary, and you know, I don't think it's ever a wrong time to tell someone that they mean a lot to you, that you know, their being in your life is valuable and precious.
And I think it comes to my mind that, you know, I struggle with our kids sometimes, and still. Especially Josh is still at the age where play with me. I mean, I can't. You know, what am I speaking to him every time I say I can't? You know, or if you have a friend that calls you and says, hey, can you come over? No, I can't. I don't mean to throw that heavy thought out there.
Well, no, it's true. You know, and you have to weigh out the priorities. Yes, we do need to get things done, but, you know, Mary has chosen that better part, you know, and it's not going to be taken from her. It's having that in your mind. Yeah, there's a list in my mind of all the things I have to get done. And really, stop and play. That y'all can pray for me because I struggle with that one. And I know it's necessary. I mean, there are times when I do. I mean, I do play with my son. Don't think I don't. but. I mean, I really need wisdom each moment that happens because, you know, he's growing, he's developing. And, you know, every action or non-action speaks something, speaks volumes.
He was very sensitive too.
Yes.
You're very sensitive. But sometimes it's not what you say, it's how it's said.
Right.
Which is huge.
So, are these little snippets of Jesus' personality, are they helping you at all? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would enjoy it.
That's good. So there's about 12 more. We probably won't get through all of them before we'll have to take a break from it, because the series that I'm wanting to do, I've got to have it on a particular timeline. I wanted to share it with everybody since the first time that Michelle and I went through it, and that was 10 years ago. Wasn't it?
You doing this or something?
No, it's something different. It's called Growing Kids God's Way, but it's all about marriage and family. Obviously, it wasn't the right time, but the fact that we're opening up the class, there are people within the school that need to have it, and so there's more than likely going to be a couple families joining us when we go through it. And anyway, so. We'll get as far as we can, and when we're done with that, we'll pick back up. But, I really, really, really enjoy hearing things come from you guys. That's awesome. Because it shows me there's something going on the inside. Interactive is very refreshing to someone who's speaking. I mean, you know when you speak and speak and speak, and you wonder, is anybody getting it? All right. Father God, we just want to thank you that you are, first of all, that you're generous. God, you lavish such amazing love and mercy and grace on us. We just don't even know how to respond sometimes. And I pray, Lord, that we would respond well and that we would receive what you so freely want to give us, and that we wouldn't reject those amazing gifts that you want to pour out on us. I'm grateful for them. And I want to have a heart that's sensitive enough to want to receive them. Lord, I thank you that you're so wonderfully honest with us. And even when you speak things in our life that sometimes are painful because it's just something we weren't ready to deal with, you knew and do know now is the time. So in all of these things, God, just help our hearts to be sensitive and to know and to respond, just to receive, whether it's feels good, makes me feel warm and fuzzy, or the warming of a rear end. God, you love those that you chasten. We're grateful, Lord, for a word of correction when it's needed. So we just give you thanks and praise because you're a loving and balanced Father. You know what and when to do what needs to be done. We give honor to you, and I pray that everyone here would just open themselves up to receive all that you have for them. In Jesus' name.